Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.
From KVPR, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, why Latino voters could decide the recall election. And later, we'll introduce you to the California Prison Poetry Project. But first, we've all been paying close attention to what's happening in Afghanistan, especially after the explosions yesterday near the Kabul airport that killed more than a dozen U.S. service members and scores of Afghans. The airport is the only way out for civilians trying to flee the country, and for some Afghans living here in the valley, it's been excruciating waiting to see if their family members will be able to get out. KVPR's Sarith Hawk spoke to two women in Fresno about their concerns. Both asked not to use their real names because they fear the Taliban will retaliate against loved ones.
An Afghan woman who asked to be called Sana places a spread of dried fruit and nuts on the dinner table in her small apartment. It's in keeping with Afghan culture.
When we have guests, it's must. You should serve them green tea or black tea.
She is still following tradition for the guests in her home tonight, even though all she can think of is her mother, sister, brother, and sister-in-law. Sana's family has been making the dangerous trip to the Kabul airport every night since mid-August, desperately trying to get inside ahead of August 31st, the U.S. deadline for withdrawal.
Like, my sister-in-law is pregnant now. And they went there and then they had very trouble in a bad time there because it was gun shooting everywhere.
There is no other way out of the country. All the borders are closed.
So the flight is the only way they have right now, and I don't know what's going to happen.
The timing is urgent. After August, no one knows what will happen with Taliban rule. The Islamic militants have been searching for and targeting Afghans with U.S. ties. Most of Sana's family are green card holders, except her brother, who is still waiting for his visa to be processed.
If they can get into the airport, then yeah, green card is helpful because my sister-in-law, she can take my brother with her.
Sana says the Taliban takeover caught everyone by surprise. She and her family had just gone to Kabul to celebrate her brother's wedding in July. Sana and most of her family returned to Fresno in early August, and the rest had planned to fly back in September.
Just everything changed very suddenly, and the Taliban just took all the Afghanistan in just a week.
Dalia Hussein, a peer support specialist with FIRM, or Fresno Interdenominational Refugee Ministries, knows these stories all too well. She escaped Iraq and ISIS in 2005.
I was really attached to the stories of the families back there. It's really similar to Taliban's policy, and it's all about killing.
Hussein has been in contact with four Afghan families in Fresno going through similar situations. Tonight, she's in Sana's apartment helping another Afghan woman who asked to be called Batul. She's filling out papers, petitioning to bring a sister and her children to the U.S. Right now, they're in Turkey, and Batul fears they will be sent back to Afghanistan.
Your address, please. Full address.
One of the papers is a release of information for Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. They're hoping Feinstein will advocate on her behalf to the State Department.
This one, you're going to write your name again here, please.
Batul also has three other sisters and a brother trapped in Kabul. Batul says she hasn't been able to sleep or get her schoolwork done at Fresno City College. She says she's been glued to her phone.
I called my family. And I ask them, you're okay? You have something to eat? How is your daughter?
The feeling of helplessness can be overwhelming, she says.
I'm not relaxed here. I feel I'm inside Afghanistan.
It's especially dangerous for women and girls right now in Afghanistan who could be forced into marriage with Taliban soldiers.
The Taliban rules abuse our people.
Christine Barker is FIRM's executive director. She says she and her staff have been paying close attention to the developments in Afghanistan.
We've been deeply afraid and also just intensely aware of the importance of time right now.
Barker says FIRM has been writing multiple letters of support for Afghan individuals, submitting the letters to congressional offices to pressure the State Department for their safe exit.
There are people who have every right to come back to the U.S., right, who have green cards, who have citizenship, who can't come back here, and because of the status that they already have are incredibly at risk.
For now, she says, hope is the best thing they can offer to families.
Hope and write letters. Hope and get other people to write letters. Hope and listen. Hope and keep going.
Sanaa says she turns to her Islamic faith for hope.
We believe in prayers, so we are just praying to for my brothers and other Afghans out there to be safe and come safely home.
All around Sanaa's home are signs of her connection to her culture. Hand-woven rugs that cover the floor and a hand-woven map of Afghanistan hangs on a wall.
You know, it's our nation, and we really love our nation. Taliban not only destroyed Afghanistan, but our feelings.
She says the Taliban is trying to change the identity of Afghanistan.
Even they changed our flag, you know, and it's very hard, you know, I can't even explain. They changed our flag.
Still, she says the Afghan people are incredibly resilient, even in the midst of what feels like hopelessness. They have a will to survive, she says, if only given the chance. For KVPR News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
And we just got word this morning that Sanaa's family, including her brother, have been safely evacuated to Qatar. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. California public health experts consider heat-related illness and death to be fully preventable. And California is one of a few states in the country with laws on the books meant to protect workers. But Californians continue to get sick and die. As part of a collaboration among the investigative unit at Columbia Journalism School, NPR, and KPCC, Jacob Margolis looks at the scope of the problem.
To understand California's efforts to prevent heat deaths, you've got to go back to May of 2008.
Another ugly day for stocks.
The housing crisis was in full swing. Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor, and 17-year-old Maria Isabel Vasquez Jimenez had made her way from Oaxaca to the United States. She wanted to help her mom live a better life at home, says her uncle Doroteo Jimenez. She got hired to tie up white wine grapevines at a vineyard near Stockton for the same company that made two-buck chuck for Trader Joe's.
Y lamentablemente, pues no tuvo suerte, ¿verdad?
One day, Maria was out in the field working when temperatures crept up into the high 80s. Her supervisors didn't provide water or shade for some 9 hours while she baked in the sun, according to a Cal OSHA investigation. Dehydrated and suffering from heat stroke, she collapsed and died a short time later. It was in the hospital that they found out that Maria was actually 2 months pregnant.
Pero pues nadie hizo nada y pues sí me dio mucho, más bien me dio mucho más coraje que tristeza.
Doroteo says he's angry because it could have been avoided. California already had heat standards in place when Maria died. Her death made clear that the bare minimum shade, water, and rest still weren't being provided. Here's then-Governor Schwarzenegger.
It's inexcusable that those people that pick the fruits and the vegetables and do all this kind of work, that they shouldn't get the right working conditions.
Since our heat laws went into effect, 73 workers have died from heat, according to data from Cal OSHA. 5 workers died just last year, and multiple experts we spoke with told us there's a good chance that the number is even higher. Jisung Park is an economist with UCLA.
Yeah, we'd not be surprised if the more we learn, the more we realize it's a much bigger issue than we thought.
It's unclear how many people get sick from heat on the job in California each year, in part because California doesn't track hospitalizations due to heat, something that other states do. In a recent study, Park estimates annually heat plays a role in some 15 to 25,000 workplace injuries. He pulled workers' comp claims and looked at how hot it was when an injury happened, because heat impacts physical and cognitive ability.
At any point above a daily max temperature of 75 or so, we see significant effects on injury risk. That risk goes up precipitously when you're in the 90, 95, 100 plus range.
And there are plenty of times when someone falls ill from heat and it's attributed to an underlying condition. The fact that people suffer from heat illness when it's 80 degrees out doesn't bode well for our future, because of course, hotter temperatures are becoming more common as the climate warms. The state could see the number of extreme heat days increase by as much as 20 times in the next 3 decades, according to California's EPA. And to fully realize the scale of the problem, California needs to effectively track who's suffering from heat so that we can figure out the best ways to protect them. From Los Angeles, I'm Jacob Margolis.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. You've just heard our colleague at KPCC, Jacob Margolis, report on how Californians continue to get sick and die from heat-related illnesses. Now he tells us more about the state agency that's supposed to protect workers. It's been understaffed for years.
A big part of Cal OSHA's job is enforcing heat laws meant to keep workers safe. And to do that, they need to send out inspectors to investigate workplaces. Well, as of August 1st, the agency had 195 full-time inspectors, 195 people for a state with roughly 18 million workers.
I think we've accepted death and even serious injuries and illnesses to all workers as a price of business.
That's Ellen Wydus. She headed Cal OSHA from 2011 to 2013. She says the agency was understaffed when she was in charge and remains understaffed today.
There simply is not enough field enforcement. There's not enough strong site penalties issued that actually force employer compliance.
Cal OSHA refused our request for an interview, but in a written statement acknowledged they need to hire more people. And in the agency's budget request from this January wrote, quote, "The need to address health hazards has grown beyond our current capacity." An independent analysis commissioned by the agency found that it will likely need an additional 150 inspectors in the next couple years. That's nearly twice as many as the agency has today. Garrett Brown was a Cal OSHA inspector for about 2 decades. He now spends his time tracking staffing issues at the agency.
You have an agency that, frankly, is just crippled.
Former and current Cal OSHA employees, as well as agency documents, say that the lack of staffing has resulted in things like slow response times to complaints, which can give employers time to cover up negligence, an overwhelming caseload for inspectors that can force them to limit the scope of investigations, and inspectors having to depend on complaints from workers who may be afraid to complain in the first place, especially if they're undocumented. In its statement, Cal OSHA laid out additional ways it is attempting to improve its enforcement practices, such as by streamlining the citation process.
There are many employers still in 2021 who are not complying with the heat standard, and there are, because of the shortages, not sufficient enforcement pressure on the bad-acting employers, which are not just a small number, unfortunately.
When we asked current and former Cal OSHA officials why the agency has been understaffed for so long, we heard some salaries aren't competitive, and that even when Cal OSHA knows they want to hire someone, the Department of Industrial Relations, Cal OSHA's parent agency, is slow-rolling approving new hires. That's something that DIR denies. Cal OSHA was approved for 70 additional positions in the latest state budget and says it is trying to hire as quickly as possible. Here's Brown again.
Now, we keep hearing that, you know, the hiring's about to take off, and not to worry, everything's under control. But that's the message we've gotten for several years now, and I'll believe it when I see it.
Part of the reason for the chronic understaffing, multiple people told us, is simply political will. that business interests are powerful in California, especially compared to a vulnerable, often undocumented worker population. Cal OSHA said even one work-related death or serious injury is too many. But as temperatures rise due to climate change, workers will face more risk because of heat and need a robust enforcement body that's able to protect them. From Los Angeles, I'm Jacob Margolis.
Jacob co-reported these stories with Brian Edwards of Columbia Journalism Investigations as part of a collaboration among the investigative unit at Columbia Journalism School, NPR, and KPCC. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Governor Gavin Newsom has less than 3 weeks to convince voters to keep him in office. And recent polls indicate that the electorate is almost evenly split. To learn the latest on the recall and why Latino voters could decide the election, I spoke to CalMatters political reporter Laurel Rosenhall.
I'll go ahead and start with a question that's on most people's minds. What are the odds that this recall effort is going to be successful?
Well, making predictions in politics is always risky, so I'm not going to make a prediction. But what I will say is that this race, more than most, is really going to be about turnout, because if Californians vote in the sort of patterns that they normally do, the numbers that they normally do, there's just so many more Democrats in California than Republicans that the recall will probably be defeated. But what polls have shown all summer is that Democrats were not really paying very much attention to this race, didn't really know it was happening, didn't really think it was a big deal, didn't really think it mattered very much, and they just weren't really tuned in and therefore were not seen as very likely to vote. On the other hand, Republicans are extremely fired up, as well as the independent voters who are unhappy with Newsom. Basically, the people who are for the recall are really excited. Obviously, it's a big accomplishment that they got this on the ballot. It's an opportunity to do a, you know, historic ousting of the Democrat leader of the largest state in the nation. And so they're very excited and they're absolutely going to vote. So the question here is really whether, you know, people who hadn't been tuned in so far pay attention and turn in their ballots.
Let's talk more about this turnout question. You know, what is driving these concerns? Is it just lack of awareness? Is it because it's a special election? Is it this assumption that the governor was safe? Is it just apathy over Newsom, especially in light of his response to the pandemic? Like, what are you hearing from folks?
Well, I think there's a lot of different factors at play. One is the special election factor. This is obviously not a year when we would normally have an election. It's not a time when we would normally have an election. You know, the date is September 14th. A lot of people just weren't expecting it. And then there are people who maybe don't want a Republican to be the governor of California, but don't necessarily love Gavin Newsom. So there could be a little bit of a lack of enthusiasm there. So I think there's a lot of different factors that are making this close. And obviously the pandemic is a huge wild card that we're all living through. You know, a couple months ago, it looked like our state was on the road to recovery. We were reopening the economy. The initial bumpy rollout of the vaccine had been improved. Virus rates, infection rates were very low. Things were seeming really positive. Now we're in the midst of a, you know, serious surge, and places are, you know, having to do mask requirements and other things. And so that affects people's mindsets as well. And voters can, you know, blame the person at the top. So there's a lot of wild cards in this race.
And certainly getting back to timing, the wildfires can't be helping the situation either.
Absolutely. And the drought as well. So, I mean, there are some serious problems in California, and those are all feeding into this.
So the Newsom campaign throughout this recall effort has really portrayed the recall as an attack by, you know, these quote unquote Trump Republicans. Does that messaging seem to be resonating with the Democratic base?
Well, I think that, you know, we will see that based on how many Democrats turn in their ballots. So far, it's only been a couple of days, so it's really, really early. But the rate of people mailing in ballots so far has been pretty strong for among Democrats. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to hold up that way, that, you know, this thing is far from over. We obviously have another almost 3 weeks before the election day on September 14th. But Trump remains a seriously unpopular kind of boogeyman for California Democrats. So it makes sense that Newsom is doing that. And, you know, he did successfully keep any really well-known Democrats from running to replace him. And he did come out with the support of lots of, you know, nationally well-known Democrats like Senator Elizabeth Warren and Vice President Kamala Harris. Bernie Sanders is supporting him. We expect to see President Biden out here campaigning for him. So he did succeed in getting the entire Democratic establishment behind him. And that helps with that anti-Trump message. But on the other hand, what's hurting him is that there are lots of people who are Democrats who are on this replacement ballot. They're not well known. They haven't held elected office. They're not running with the support of the party, but they do have the label Democrat. And so when voters look at their ballot, they won't necessarily see this as a 100% Republican driven recall.
Can you explain the Democratic strategy of asking voters to leave that second half of the ballot blank?
Well, I think that this is about a couple things. One is just simply trying to make the message as simple as possible. That second question that lists the 46 different candidates, it's complicated. It's difficult for people to decide who to vote for. If you're inclined to vote for Republican, you may have heard of one of the Republican candidates and have a favorite. If you are inclined to vote for a Democrat, you have a bunch of options of people you probably haven't heard of. So for the Newsom campaign, it's extremely simple to just tell people to vote no and not have to do any other further explaining. I do think this is a strategy, though, that is good for Newsom, but maybe not good for Californians, because if the recall passes and the winner is chosen by a bunch of voters who didn't fill out that second question, that means the winner will be chosen by a very small number of voters. So it does seem like, in that sense, it's a strategy that could be helpful to him to defeat the recall. That's all he really needs to do, is to get a majority of people to vote no on question number one. But if things don't go his way and the yes side wins, then the winner could be picked by an extremely small segment of the electorate if a lot of voters leave that second one blank. And then there's one other aspect, I think, that's behind this strategy, and that is the history of what happened in 2003 when Governor Gray Davis was recalled. At that time, there was a prominent Democrat who was on the ballot. That was the Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante. And the thinking at the time was that he would be like an insurance policy for Democrats. In case the recall were to pass, then, you know, perhaps a Democrat could still hang on to the governor's office. And his campaign slogan was vote no on the recall, vote yes on Bustamante. So there are definitely some sort of political consultants and insiders now who think that that was a confusing and ultimately losing message that was just too nuanced and difficult to explain to the voters. And so this time around, they're just really focusing on the no part of the message rather than, you know, the alternative replacement candidate question that's number two.
So you've done some really fascinating reporting on the power of Latino voters to potentially decide this election. And, you know, with the caveat that, of course, the Latino voting bloc is big, it is diverse, and it is not a monolith. But,
absolutely.
You know, that said, tell us a little bit about what you learned in your reporting.
Well, you know, Latino voters have the potential to really be, you know, swing voters in this election. Latinos are the largest ethnic group in California, 39% of the population. They're a growing share of the electorate with about 28% of registered voters. And both sides in this recall are really trying to court Latino votes. In the context of the pandemic, it's also very interesting because so many Latino communities around the state were really hit hard by the pandemic, whether you're talking about job losses, school closures, infection rates, death rates. Latino communities have been hit very, very hard by the pandemic. And so given the pandemic context of this election, that's another important factor. And so what we're seeing is Newsom really trying hard to show Latino voters what he has done to help Latino communities. He's been highlighting his approval of an expansion of the Medi-Cal health insurance program, that he's signed a bill expanding it to include undocumented immigrants starting at age 50. This was a priority for the Latino caucus for many years, and he's been highlighting his, you know, aid, various sort of pandemic relief programs that he's approved, $600 stimulus payments, rent relief, help paying off utility bills for people who fell behind in their utilities during the pandemic. Oh, and I should also add, you know, obviously he's appointed Alex Padilla as the United States Senator when Kamala Harris became vice president. And Padilla is the first Latino to ever represent California in the United States Senate. So Newsom is trying to demonstrate all of that. At the same time, you have the pro-recall side that is really reaching out to Latinos and tapping into the anger over, you know, how the pandemic had such a lopsided impact. And so we're seeing the pro-recall side are also, you know, putting ads out in Spanish, creating particular committees targeting Latinos who are for the recall. And Kevin Faulkner, one of the Republican candidates, you know, his very first ad that he put out was him speaking in Spanish and telling voters that the recall was a major opportunity to fix what's wrong in California. So we are seeing a lot of activity, and research by political scientists has shown that if Latinos vote in the way that they normally do in special elections, then they will, their influence will be watered down. So if Latinos turn out and vote, they could have, you know, a lot of influence on this race. But there is also the question of how much they'll turn out to vote.
And then, of course, that endorsement from Bernie Sanders is going to be significant, too, for that population, right?
Absolutely. You know, he won the Democratic primary in California last year, largely fueled by a huge amount of enthusiasm he generated among young Latinos. So I'm very curious to see if we're going to see a Tio Bernie commercial come on the airwaves. I don't know if it'll happen, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Neither would I. Well, I've been talking with CalMatters political reporter Laurel Rosenhall. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Middle school teacher and Fresno-based podcaster Jordan Maddox recently founded the California Prison Poetry Contest. He's currently collecting short poems from incarcerated men and women throughout the state. Entrants have a chance to win cash prizes and be published in a literary magazine. I spoke to Maddox about what he hopes to accomplish with the contest and how the idea grew from conversations with his wife, who works as a psychologist at Avenal State Prison.
I was always inspired by what she was doing and wanted to find a way to get involved. And so I kind of had this itch for some kind of involvement with the prison system in California to support people that are, you know, trying to rehabilitate. It's, you know, CDCR is California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And so I was looking for some way to be involved. And then I read about a contest that was held in Texas called the Insider Prize. And it's hosted by the American Short Fiction. It's run by a couple, Maurice and Emily Shama. And essentially what they do is they collect short fiction or essays and have a basically a guest judge select the best submission for the year from a Texas prison. And I ended up connecting with Maurice and learning more about why he started it and the kinds of things that he's able to do and the communication he's able to have with people in the system in Texas. And all those things kind of combined. And the third thing I would say is just my love of poetry and my and seeing poetry as a way to connect with the human aspect of these people. Many of you are incarcerated in California for long periods of time and spend most of their lives in a state of suffering. And I saw this was a path to give them opportunity to have a voice, humanize people that are often dehumanized and see what would come of it. It's something that when I started, I was uncertain of where it would go or where it would take me. But since I've started, the contest started in June of this year. The amount of submissions is just overwhelming. I have a small P.O. box in Fresno because I was trying to be cheap. And the P.O. box is a little bit like, if you know the reference from Harry Potter when he's getting his letter to Hogwarts and the letters just come spewing in through the fireplace at one point, you know, that's a little bit of like what it's like to go to my P.O. box every day. And I make sure to open up every single one of them up that day and read whatever it is. And usually it's accompanied with some kind of a letter or note. And it's not just men, it's men and women from prisons, you know, all the way from San Diego, all the way to the northern part of California. And a lot of these folks that are sending me mail are just thanking me for just an opportunity to just to do something positive or productive. One letter that I read said, the person said in the letter that he had written poetry for a long time in the first decade that he was in prison. But for the last 20 years, he just didn't have the creative juices inside of him to write. And attached to that note was what he said was the first poem he'd written in 20 years. And, you know, I think at the core of it, what this contest is about is believing that humans can change and get better. And I think if we believe in the R at the end of CDCR, there needs to be a lot more things like this that give people a chance to have some sense of redemption. And I use that word redemption in its non-religious sense, but for a lot of these guys, they use the word redemption in their poetry a lot in the spiritual sense, because which they makes see sense. This as yeah. a path. Yeah. So it's been quite a journey in just the first few months of collecting submissions. And I'm at a point where I'm both overwhelmed constantly emotionally, but also overwhelmed administratively and getting and organizing all of these wonderful submissions.
It certainly sounds like it. You know, given the volume of poetry that you've received so far, what themes have emerged, if any?
A lot of the themes are religious. We have a lot of themes of sin and redemption and wrestling through. You know, suffering is something that is really common. But then you have these themes that emerge, and they usually emerge through different motifs. Oftentimes, it can be little things that are associated with hope. You know, the things that they find in prison that get them through their time. And these can be getting a certain food item, or this can be getting a certain letter from somebody, or being able to read something or take a class. And so you definitely have a dominant religious tone to the poetry, but then you also have a lot of people just trying to make meaning of what they're experiencing and wrestling with it in deep and very emotional ways. And the poetry, I will say, is oftentimes incredibly hard to read because you're tapping into someone's experience that is one of the most challenging experiences a human can deal with, which is being incarcerated. But, you know, it also is, I feel lucky to have access and being able to hear their voices, which their voices are often, you know, muted from society. And it is a voice that I think needs to be heard because it is a part of the human experience, but not one that we often like to look at.
Could you share an example with us of one of the submissions you received?
I got a poem in for a man incarcerated at Soledad State Prison. So the title of this poem is Recompense. Hope glimmers through smoke and mist as dawn broke the storm. A crow's wings beat out auguries, kiss, lifting fates that mourn. The winds of destiny whisper no promises, culling casualty from dreams. Both scythe and sight in daybreak's light, alluding to greater things. And yet, just yet, as the heart beats on, so faith runs through, bringing grander than a thousand prayers, come recompense as truth.
So what has this process been like for you, logistically speaking? How has it been working with the prison system?
So initially, I worked with an organization called the William James Association, and their wonderful director, Lori Brooks, was very helpful in directing me to the right people to talk with within CDCR. But since I've reached out to them, they not only have expressed gratitude for the contest, but also went out of their way to approve it and communicate this with the different councils that meet at the different facilities, and made sure that advertisements for the contest were placed on almost every bulletin board in every facility. So they've been nothing but supportive, and you know, I'm eternally grateful to them. They have made this easy for me in a lot of ways.
So talk about the contest itself. What is going to happen to this collection of poetry when the contest ends?
So the contest closes in June of 2022. And at that point, we have a group of readers who are associated with the publication that will publish the winning poems, which is the Red Wheelbarrow. And these readers will screen out a selection of finalists, and then we will have what we call a celebrity judge or a guest judge select the winners. That celebrity judge or guest judge is to be announced, but that is the process for which the winners will be selected. And then the top five poems will be published in the Red Wheelbarrow, and the top three poems will also receive a cash prize.
And for those listening who may want to help out in this endeavor, what do you suggest they do?
Well, I think the first thing would be to visit the website, which is CAPPC.org. So California Prison Poetry Contest. That's what the acronym stands for. There you can read more about the contest. You can also support us financially if this is something that you want to support. We have a GoFundMe page that's listed on the website under the support section. And then just stay tuned when we publish the poems. I would appreciate people buying a copy of the Red Wheelbarrow and reading the poetry. And we will also put the winning poems on the website as well, so you can read them there as well.
I've been talking with Jordan Maddox, the founder of the California Prison Poetry Contest. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things many of us have missed during the pandemic is live music. It began its return this summer, but with the Delta variant, there are still plenty of uncertainties. KVPR's David Ouse spoke with Valley Music Venues about how they're dealing with the ever-evolving COVID situation.
That's the sound of legendary band Los Lobos performing at World Records in Bakersfield. World Records is a record store with a difference. They have their own theater for concerts. Here's owner Pat Evans.
We opened our record store in 1982, and then in 1997, seeing the need for recording artists to come to Bakersfield that otherwise weren't having a chance to play, we started putting on concerts. Over the years of doing 130 concerts at 19 different venues, we longed for a place of our own that could have proper sound and lighting and be a great experience for both artists and the fans that came to see them. So my wife and I bought an old furniture building, and we got a whopper bank loan to finance a major renovation so we could put in a great theater. And we did our first concert in our new place in May of 2017 with Elvin Bishop. We've done 40 concerts since, going all the way until a weekend, March 6th and 7th, 2020. And then everything shut down. Our concerts have all been canceled or rescheduled. And we're starting up again, hopefully, this September 17th to do our first concert back. We got a great list of artists coming for the remainder of 2021.
As a record store owner, for the retail portion of your business, you've been very careful in observing COVID protocols. How are you dealing with the evolving circumstances with the rise of Delta variant and like that?
It's been obvious from the start to me that we couldn't contribute to the spread of COVID, that we had to participate in getting COVID behind us. So it was just natural that we did all our business out in front of the store, that we didn't have people come in, that nobody was going to get sick inside World Records to buy music, and that we weren't going to have concerts until it was safe to do so.
What guidance are you using and what protocols are you using to keep live performance safe for your fans, for your artists, and for your staff and yourself?
As specified by the artists and is becoming quite common across the country, the common strategy is to only allow people into a theater or a festival after they present proof of vaccination or proof of a negative COVID test within some places 72 hours, others go into 48 hours, so that you don't have the virus come inside. And some places are mandating effective masks properly worn. We are not mandating that. We are strongly encouraging that. And we've had many, many months to let this be settled opinion that if you wear a great mask, you can keep yourself from getting the virus, and you can keep yourself from spreading the virus to other people.
That was Pat Evans, owner of World Records in Bakersfield. For another perspective, I spoke with Frank Delgado, floor manager at Lucy's Lounge, a place known for designer cocktails and live music.
We are the venue that features live music. Prior to the pandemic, it was 7 days a week. And then once things started reopening, we started with Friday, Saturdays, then Thursday through Saturday, we continued to add one additional day. And we are back at live music at 7 days a week.
How are staff at Lucy's keeping safe? How are patrons keeping themselves safe?
In the earliest days of the reopening, we started with extreme caution. We had limited capacity. We had built a patio in the back behind our building, and we were sharing it with our neighbors. And so we were able to then feature the live music outside. We had just a guy and a guitar in the back a couple days a week. I think people realized during this time of lockdown how much they not only missed music, because they could put on Pandora if they wanted, but missed the actual experience of sitting somewhere and listening to someone create music live in front of them that they enjoy. One of the questions that we were getting over the phone, emails, etc., it was, when's the live music coming back? When's the live music coming back? This is one of the driving forces that people were really, really interested. They had missed it so much. And once we started reintroducing it, and once we were able to actually have people come back inside, we were just trying to be as careful as possible, as is possible. It's a small lounge. And so as people would come in, I'm the floor manager, and I'd greet them at the door and say, hold on a second. And we wouldn't actually even let them in unless there was a table for them to sit at. We removed some tables, and then after removing them, we spaced them out. We were using every other table. And so we were seating people, and at times people had to wait outside for 15, 20 minutes. All of our staff have all been vaccinated. We've all had our jab. You know, we're really trying to do the best we can, follow the rules, keep our staff and our patrons safe, and at the same time, really try to operate in a way that is going to provide the best experience for the greatest number of people. we are watching the numbers every day. It's really scary. It really is very, very scary to see what's happening all across the United States. And so if we need to go back out in the patio, and if we need to do that again and figure out how we're going to do it, we're going to figure it out and take care of our people.
That was Frank Delgado of Lucy's Lounge in Fresno's Tower District. For one more point of view, I got some insight from Tony Martin of Fulton 55, a concert venue in central Fresno.
You know, we've been open now, 7 weeks since we reopened. Of course, every week since we've reopened, it just seems like the COVID is getting a little stronger. Variants are coming into play. Right now, we're just following state guidelines. It's still kind of the honor system. You know, if you're not vaccinated, you're supposed to mask up. And we do see people masked up. My staff, for the most part, we're all masked up when we're indoors all the time. 2 weeks ago, we started taking everybody's temperature before they come in. Anybody with a fever, we're not allowing in. And so far, we've not had to turn anyone away from having a fever or whatever. And we're getting close because we have some artists insist that we follow. We want to check vaccination cards or proof of a negative COVID test. And they're saying if they can't provide any of that, that they must be masked at all times while in the venue. So we're probably going to be jumping on that bandwagon here very soon as well. The policy that we're looking at is proof of vaccination or proof of a negative COVID test within 72 hours of the show. For us, it's a bit of a catch-22 because we've been shut down for 16 months and we're just trying to, you know, make some money and come back to life again, if you will.
Tony Martin explained to me how Fulton 55 took advantage of the downtime of the pandemic to do some renovation of their space inside and out.
2021 in January was our 10-year anniversary. So we didn't even get to have our 10-year anniversary party. But we had made plans to do some things inside the venue. So we just took the time, instead of being depressed and upset about things, we implemented some of the stuff that we wanted to do for our anniversary anyway. And by being closed, it afforded us the time to do it without being rushed because, oh my God, we got to do this and this before the next show. Even the mural outside, that kind of came about a month and a half into the pandemic of being shut down. And we're like thinking, what can we do to make ourselves kind of happier, you know, more uplifting? And then, boom, hey, let's do a mural, you know. And that day we got a hold of Josh Wigger, and 3 months later we have this beautiful mural on our building. And, you know, that kind of got us up and pumped and excited, you know, hey, we're doing stuff, you know, even though we're shut down and, you know, we're spending money that we don't really have coming back into us at the time. But, you know, sometimes you make that investment because you just need to.
One thing's clear from everyone I spoke with, they're all just doing their part to keep the music playing on. For Valley Edition, I'm David Alves.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. A new children's museum is opening to the public next month in Merced. It will be the first of its kind in the city's history. To learn more about the Kids Discovery Station, I spoke to one of its co-founders, UC Merced Professor of Applied Mathematics, Maya Talkman.
So why is it important for Merced to have its own children's museum?
There are so many reasons why it's important. First of all, we really need to invest in our kids. Merced doesn't necessarily have a lot of educational and entertainment and engagement opportunity for kids. You know, there are sports that you can sign up for. There are a lot of scheduled activities. But if it's 120 degrees in the afternoon, which happens quite often in Merced, and you just want to go somewhere with your kid and spend great time together, learning together and discovering together, there are not that many options. Wouldn't it be great if there was some kind of a center where they could go and enjoy and play and learn together with their families? So that's one big reason. And another big reason is that We have shortage of specialists, of professionals, of, you know, people with really very much necessary skills in Merced and in the Valley in general. If you talk to local firemen, they're saying that they can't get enough applications from local people. If you go to ER in the hospital, almost all the doctors are driving from the Bay Area, and all the doctor's offices are complaining that there's not enough technicians. If you talk to farmers, they're constantly looking for people who know how technology works, how ag technology works, and they can't find enough people. If you talk to construction crews, it's the same deal. And so we really need to bring our own. We really need to open the eyes for kids about opportunities that exist, about professions that exist, about what happens in the world and what happens in their own region. So that's really kind of the major two reasons why we need it in Merced.
I understand the museum will open to the public in September. What can the public expect?
So the public can expect to have a place where they can come as a family and they can play, they can learn, they can discover together, they can just spend quality time. We have quite a few beautiful surprises and exhibits for everybody involved. And for example, we have a whole section for little ones from ages zero to five. And this has been sponsored by First Five Merced County. It's called Little Explorers Planet. And in Little Explorers Planet, little ones can just crawl and touch different surfaces and explore and twist some things and turn some things and make them rattle. Or you can climb a spaceship, which is like a maze and has four levels. And this is really promoting the gross motor skills and skills in kids and also development, and also helps them learn how to solve puzzles. And we have Explorers Canteen and Supply Base where they can cook up some meals, healthy meals for superheroes and for little aliens, and they can learn about what is healthy eating. We have a health center exhibit, which is sponsored by Golden Valley Health Clinics, and little kids can learn how to be doctors or veterinarians or pediatricians or any medical profession you can think of. We have a big exhibit called Innovation Island, where they can learn how to code, where they can learn how electronics works, where they can get acquainted with mechanical machines, how mechanics works. So we really have a lot of different areas for different interests, because kids really, the interests vary quite widely. You know, one kid might be really into dinosaurs and another kid might be really into tech. So we have quite a variety of different exhibits for kids with different inclinations.
How can the public help?
So we are right now, there's a very unique opportunity for organizations and individuals to become founding partners of the museum. This is going to last until the end of September when we open. And quite a few organizations already came on board. We have organizations like Merced County Office of Education, First Five Merced County, Golden Valley Health Clinics. We have High Speed Rail Authority, which is sponsoring a mock-up of a high-speed train. But we're really looking more for founding partners and for sponsors who can help us make this a reality.
I've been talking with Maya Talkman, professor of applied mathematics at UC Merced and the co-founder of the Kids Discovery Station in Merced. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. Technical support is from Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, working to build a more effective, compassionate, and just healthcare system. On the web at chcf.org/health-equity.